Michelle Martin. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're in North Carolina today, broadcasting from member station WNCU on the campus of North Carolina Central University in Durham. Coming up, the Barbershop Guys take on the week in politics and sports. But first, we're here in Durham participating in a conference about race politics at Duke University. Many of the country's best-known scholars on race and minority issues have come together to ask a central question. Is our country still divided by race? Is the U.S. still two nations? 40 years after the Kerner Commission report on race and 4 months after the historic election of our first African-American president, Barack Obama, have the color lines faded? I'm joined now by three of the conference participants, each widely regarded for his or her research and writing on the subject of race in America. William Sandy Darity is the director of Duke University's Research Network on Racial and Ethnic Inequality. Paula McLean is also a professor at Duke and the co-director of the University Center for the Study of Race, Ethnicity, and Gender in the Social Sciences. And Bonnie Thornton-Dill is the chair of the Women's Studies Department and the founding director of the Consortium on Race, Gender, and Ethnicity at the University of Maryland. Welcome, professors, all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to start with the sort of the founding principle of the conference. In 1968, the Kerner Commission, which was formed to assess the cause of race riots that had started in 1967, concluded that the United States was a country divided by race. 4 decades later, election of Barack Obama. Are we still divided? Bonnie Thornton-Dill?
Well, yes and no. Yes, we are still divided. Race still matters. But it is more complex. It's more varied. So yes, race still exists, but it is more complex.
Sandy Darity?
Absolutely. Race still matters. In some sense, the white Americans who have decided to support President Obama or decided to vote for him are getting racial reconciliation on the cheap, in the sense that deep and enduring inequalities remain unaddressed, and white America doesn't have to pay the price of trying to address those racial inequalities.
Paula McLean.
The answer is yes. And picking up on Bonnie's and Sandy's comments is that there are some structural issues related to race that the election of our president don't automatically eliminate.
Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, let me give you a couple of examples. About 3/4 of whites before this downturn owned their own homes, compared to only about 48% of blacks. But what we found in terms of research is that blacks and whites with the same credit scores, same incomes, that blacks were more likely to be denied mortgage loans or shifted into the subprime mortgage market. Now, if you have the same qualifications or the same economic as, why do blacks then get pushed to the subprime market? Which means with this meltdown, there are more blacks now in terms of the ability to get housing that are going to be affected than are whites.
What would account for that?
I don't like evidence by anecdote, but I'm going to use one here that I think illustrates part of the problem. The last time my husband and I closed on a loan, you know, when you close, you go to closing, there's that little area at the bottom that asks you to identify, if you choose, your race so that the Department of Housing and Urban Development can keep track of the loans. The last time my husband and I went to close, our race was already filled out. And do you know what they filled out?
No.
White. The assumption was that with our credit information and salaries, that we had to be white. Now, who would do that? Why would someone pre-fill out the forms? Now, I thought maybe it was idiosyncratic to us, but my sister who lives in Maryland, the exact same thing happened to her. That's a very troubling, troubling sign. Same thing with automobiles. Research has shown that blacks pay more for the cars initially, that a white can come in, be quoted one price, a black will come in and for the same car be quoted a different price, and that blacks then get a higher interest rate with the same economic qualifications than will whites.
Can I ask you a provocative question? Is it possible that African Americans tolerate it?
If you go in to buy a car and the salesperson, man or woman, comes out and says, well, we've checked your credit and this is what we can give you, you don't know that the white person that came in before you or after you with the same information on the same car is being given different information.
Michelle, could I inject something here?
Sure.
There's a study that I did with Rhonda Sharp and with Major Coleman where we actually compared reports of discrimination or exposure to discrimination in the workplace against independent measures of whether or not people had been subjected to wage discrimination. we found that black respondents significantly underreported the degree to which they were exposed to discrimination, and white respondents significantly overreported the degree to which they were exposed to discrimination. And so I think that generally black folks don't necessarily assume that they're being subjected to discrimination in every walk in life or in every arena.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with Professors Paula McLean, William Sandy Darity, and Bonnie Thornton Dill. We're talking about the politics of race in America. We're all attending a conference at Duke University that addresses this topic. Paula, you've also studied the connections between so-called minority groups, and I use that term because in a lot of communities, minorities are not the minority, right? But you've studied the intersections and interconnections between minority groups in the U.S., particularly between African Americans and Latinos. 40 years ago, there was not this burgeoning Latino diaspora in the United States. There were certainly Latino citizens here and have been here since before this was a country. But the fact of Latinos being the majority minority in this country did not exist 40 years ago. So how does that new dynamic shape our conversations about race? And I'd love to hear from each of you on this. Paul, if you want to start.
Well, I think what it means is that we have to move beyond the kind of black-white paradigm, but it's that dynamic, the black-white dynamic, that has structured how the United States has dealt with and deals with these other racial groups. So even though we're talking about a multiracial society, the black-white dynamic still seems to be the paradigm through which all these other groups are viewed.
But what does that mean? Does that mean that people become black?
Or they may try to become white.
Yeah.
A large proportion of the Latino community really does have a preference for a white identity and expresses that regardless of how the individual may look. And we know this from studies in which interviewers have gauged the physical appearance or physical characteristics of the respondents, where we also have the respondents telling us which racial category they self-identify with.
And what do you make of that, Sandy?
It's partially a flight from blackness. It's partially a preference to identify with the social group that does have the highest status and the greatest amount of resources, both economically and politically.
Bonnie, what do you think? You think we're stuck in a black-white paradigm?
No, we're not stuck in a black-white paradigm, but I agree with what Paula said, that the black-white paradigm does define how we've dealt with race all along. I was also going to point out that, you know, Latinos are considered an ethnic group, and on the census, they choose their racial categorization. They choose black or white. So that's also another way that you have information about how Latinos identify and the difference, in a sense, between ethnicity and race and thinking about these issues.
This leads me to a question that I was hoping we could spend our last couple of minutes thinking about, which is that I'm sure you all remember that our Attorney General Eric Holder caused quite a stir last month when he said at a Black History Month celebration at the Department of Justice that this country is in some ways a nation of cowards when it comes to race. So I wanted to ask each of you what you make of Attorney General Holder's comments, and where should conversations about race go in your view? What conversations would you like the country to be having around these areas? Bonnie, would you like to start?
Sure. Research has shown that when you look at the ways in which whites think about racial differences and blacks think about racial differences, and you look at what they call everyday racism, that whites tend to think about racism in a much narrower way than blacks do. Blacks seem to see a wider range of behaviors as racist. So I think there's a tendency on the part of whites to diminish these things, to see that they're not important, to not understand how blacks and why blacks may see race or racism in certain kinds of circumstances. It is what I would call the ignorance of privilege. And I think that people are going to have to hear and understand from people they know or have some relationship with why these things are seen as race and racism and why they're seen as important. Otherwise, the conversations are at a level where people white people tend to ignore them, think that we're whining too much, we're complaining too much. And so I don't know if that's the solution, but
There are some black people who are tired of it too, as you know, who feel that this is not productive, that these conversations are disempowering and distract people from things that are more important to getting where they need to go in life. So it's an interesting point. Sandy Darity, what about you?
I think that the most important issue from my perspective, is the wealth disparity that exists between blacks and non-blacks in America. The median white household in the United States has an average wealth level of $90,000. The median black household's wealth level is $6,000. This is a huge disparity. If black folks were to save their average level of household income for three consecutive years at 100%, they would barely bridge that gap. So that, to me, is the kind of enduring inequality that has to be addressed. And if we refuse to talk about race and racism, we'll never address that kind of inequality.
Paula McLean?
I think we've talked about race an awful lot for several hundred years, and I would like us to begin to do something about the structural inequalities that exist and do something in a very serious way. Now, whether it means we actually talk about doing these things and then do them or don't talk about them, but then we do them, is something that I would like us to do.
I'm going to end on a thought experiment. Many people, particularly a lot of African Americans, didn't think that we would have this point that there would be a President Barack Obama in the White House. In fact, I think the polling at one point before the election showed that more African Americans than whites had doubts that Barack Obama could be elected. So the question I want to ask each of you, and I know it's unfair, is are there other things that you as intellectuals think that many people think might not be possible, that might in fact be possible, as people who think a lot about race in this country? So, Professor Darity, since you don't mind my question, I'm going to start with you.
Yes. Reparations for African Americans.
Really? Interesting. Mm. Professor McLean?
I think you're going to see more blacks and other minorities run for statewide offices and Senate seats.
Professor Dill?
I think black women are going to come into their own politically and executive positions in ways we haven't seen before.
Professor Bonnie Thornton-Dill, Professor and Chair of Women's Studies at the University of Maryland. Paula McLean, Professor of Political Science at Duke University. William Sandy Darity, Professor of Public Policy Studies, African and African American Studies and Economics at Duke University. I thank you all so much.
Thanks. It's
thank
been a
you.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thanks for having us.